I'm Austin Lugo.
I'm Brandon Hess.
And this is the Nom Nom Project. So, Brandon, before we really get into the history of Vietnam and what Vietnam is, was, and continues to be, could you kind of explain what exactly the Nom Nom Project is and why we're even here?
So I think we both want the Nom Nom Project to be sort of a documentary or a catalog of all of the things that we're going to experience when we go to Vietnam. And so a lot of that requires research of the country, and there's a big lead up before we actually go there of learning about what's actually the deal over there, like what the people are like, what the government's like, and how that society came to be.
And why are we going to Vietnam?
Same reason you travel to really any country, to experience new cultures and see new things. I think Vietnam is particularly interesting, especially if you're an American, because there isn't a climate like Vietnam in the United States. And there especially isn't a people. Well, obviously there are Vietnamese people in the United States, but Western American culture is so unlike Southeast Asian culture that you can't really get the same kind of vibe anywhere else in the United States.
I was recently reading a study about the literature that's coming out of Vietnam, especially literature in the United States, and this study came out about 10 years ago, so perhaps this has changed a bit, but I imagine it hasn't changed much. And the research suggested that over 60% of the literature on Vietnam in the United States was on the Vietnam War, 30% was cooking, and 5% was about the traveling, like tourists, and only 5% of books currently in the U.S. on the country of Vietnam are actually about the history of Vietnam. So I found this project to be incredibly enlightening, because before 2 weeks ago, I honestly knew almost nothing about Vietnam except the Vietnam War, which is all you learn in American history, at least speaking from personal experience. And you're not really taught a lot about Vietnam, partly because Vietnam has a very complicated history, especially related to the United States. But I also find it's fascinating and a great challenge just how complicated it is to get good information on Vietnam. When I was looking for books to read for, you know, preparing for this podcast and for all the other stuff we do with this project, I use Audible because I'm an extremely slow reader, so I'll often listen to books. And I found like 60 books on the Vietnam War, which is fine. You know, it's important and people should read about it, and it's important to get different perspectives from Vietnam and the US and France and China and all these different perspectives. But at the same time, there's so few books. I think I'm reading the only book right now on Audible about the country of Vietnam and the history of Vietnam, which is just called A New History of Vietnam, which is an interesting name because there's not an old history. It's just that one.
Most of the information I find is from news articles online, and that can be useful, but obviously it's got a very Western bias because most Vietnamese news is not translated. And a lot of the information that is out there on Vietnam is written by state media, and especially a lot of the academic information is put in textbooks that are written in a language that is not English. So it's hard to find super good information that's not what is Vietnam from the Western perspective.
So why do you think that is? Why do you think it's so difficult to find history on Vietnam? I mean, you can find histories on China, Korea, almost every European country, many parts of Africa, Canada, Mexico, many South American countries. Why is it so hard to find histories on the country of Vietnam?
Well, I think relative to China, it's a much smaller country, and it took a lot longer to industrialize than China did. And that kind of plays into why you don't see nearly as much information. The country has been essentially a feudal society since the Vietnam War. And even after that, it has still taken them a very long time to modernize the country. I think a lot of it just comes down to the fact that Vietnam is actually like a very new state. and they're not very well integrated into the global economic system. So as a result, a lot of the information that comes out of Vietnam is written by Vietnamese people for Vietnamese people. And there's not a lot of will or interest in creating media for
I think one of the other problems when it comes to talking about Vietnam is that as an official country, it's still an incredibly new and really in many ways in its infant stages as a country, which is an interesting time to become a country within the last 50 years. It's certainly one of the newest countries in the sense of a unified set of people. I mean, of course, the tribes and communities of Vietnam go all the way back to the Han Dynasty and perhaps before. Unfortunately, much like a lot of Native American communities here in the United States, a lot of these communities were based on oral traditions and not written traditions. So to find their history is much harder. And if you actually try to find history before the Han Dynasty, it's incredibly difficult, partly because they were separate communities just that happened to live in the same area. And partly because there is nothing really written down. And since, quote unquote, modern history is built upon written history, because there's been this unfortunate academic assumption that if it's not written down, for some reason, it's not history. Oral history has often been taken as lesser. And of course, that is starting to change, especially the way we look at a lot of Native American cultures here in the US and tribal communities in New Zealand and Australia and other parts of the world. But it's still the case that when you talk about history, you're talking about what's written down. And one of the challenging things about talking about Vietnam is we have very little perspective from the people of Vietnam, really until France comes in the 1860s during the Second Opium War. I mean, there is some stuff, of course, but the problem is it's almost always from the perspective of China. It's from the perspective of France. It's from the perspective of the US. It's from the perspective of Japan. It's always from the perspective of colonizers coming to Vietnam to kind of take over the country. Often when we refer to the United States, we say it's a country of immigrants. People from across the world come here and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Of course, that ignores the very real history of natives and all the other people who lived here for hundreds, if not thousands of years before quote unquote immigrants ever came here. It's extremely imperious in a very neoliberal, globalist, capitalist way of looking at it. Not that there's anything wrong with capitalism or globalism or blah, 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 but it fails to see history from the eyes of people who actually live there. And I think this is even more true with Vietnam, because at least in the US, we've created this belief, whether it's true or not, that we broke away from colonization and basically inverted ourselves from being a colony into those that colonize. Vietnam, unfortunately, has spent most of its history being colonized by someone after someone after someone. And really, it wasn't until Ho Chi Minh in the, 1940s-ish, during World War II, that they even had the ability to attempt revolution. Of course, I'm sure there are plenty of attempts before that, but when you're reading it from the perspective of the colonizers, they don't talk about that. History's always written by the winners, so it's always challenging to grasp at who's speaking for who. And even when you read Vietnamese writers, it's often very complicated. You look at some of the most famous Vietnamese writers, filmmakers, artists, they're often not from Vietnam, or they were born in Vietnam and then left Vietnam to live in France or Japan or China or these other places because they were basically pushed away by war or poverty or what have you, which makes for a very challenging study of the country.
There was also no institution of tertiary education except for the French administrative school in Vietnam until like the 60s or sometime around then when the communist government actually started to invest in university education. So a lot of academics were forced to leave the country just to get their skills. And I've noticed a lot that there's a similar effect in Vietnam as in China, where they don't see themselves as part of a global community the way Western countries do. Like in the United States, there is less and less of a distinction between what an American is and what a British person is or what a German person is, because we're all connected through the internet. And obviously in Vietnam, the internet is essentially banned formally. It's almost impossible actually for the average Vietnamese person to even access the global community. But even without the internet, a lot of Vietnamese people are very unconcerned with politics and affairs outside of their local government within Vietnam. So it's a lot different to try to interpret Vietnamese culture because of that, since in the United States, everything is seen through the lens of what our relationship is to foreign powers. Like, our country gained its independence from another country that was on the other side of the planet. And while this was the case for Vietnam as well, they were cut off from trade from all of those countries after they created a communist state. Whereas in the United States, we continue to work very closely with European powers. So I think a lot of the reason why, again, you don't see Vietnamese media translated into English or other Western languages is because there's not a lot of desire really to even access any, I guess, markets or communities outside of very small communities within Southeast Asia, either within Vietnam or in China or Laos or Cambodia.
Yeah, in many ways, Vietnam, despite the fact that it does have some big cities like Hanoi or Ho Chi Minh, it is very much still a developing country. I mean, you look at just the demographics of the country, 3/4 of the country are still farmers. Not that there's anything wrong with farming, but it's interesting you compare it to the United States in the sense that back in the early 1800s, almost a third of all workers were farmers. And there was this terror because at the time they were creating new technologies that would make it possible that less people had to farm. And so the terror at the time was like, now only like half the amount of people are going to need to farm. So what is the other 15% of people going to do? Of course, at the time, they didn't realize that there was going to be an entire community of jobs and ecosystems built because of the industrialization of farming. Unfortunately, in Vietnam, although, of course, it's not in any ways a country living in the past, I'm not suggesting that at all, but the industrialization of farmland hasn't really happened. And part of the reason for that is because farming in Vietnam is incredibly unprofitable. And if you look at a lot of the farmers in Vietnam, they often have to have a second or a third job, which isn't as true when you're in the city. Now, the average income in Vietnam is lower than it is here in the United States. I believe in the city, it's about $1,000 a month, which in the global economy is considered a middle income country.
Very deep in poverty by United States standards, if you're living on $1,000 a month. So, yeah, I think it's very strange to try to interpret how industrialization is going in Vietnam, because obviously they have those two cities. They have Ho Chi Minh City and they have Hanoi, and those are clearly their industrial epicenters. But once you leave the cities, it's mostly just rural farmlands like it's been for the past few hundred years. And I'm paraphrasing from government documents here, so, you know, they're probably very biased, but a lot of what you hear coming out of the Vietnamese government is a concerted effort to try to develop rural areas simultaneously with urban areas. So rather than in the United States or in the United Kingdom, for example, where industrialization essentially forced everyone living in the countryside to go into the cities, or else they would starve to death because there would be no jobs after farms were industrialized, there seems to be a strong effort made to try to keep those rural communities alive, even though farms are in the process of being industrialized and those jobs are disappearing. So the economic metrics as well are difficult to understand when the country is not capitalist, because $1,000 a month doesn't get you the same like kind of things that it would if you were in a capitalist country. Like, I believe food is provided for people in Vietnam regardless of what amount of money they're making, as long as they're employed. So cost of living is a lot different when you're trying to make those calculations.
Of course, when we refer to $1,000 or however many dollars, we are referring to the American dollar, which isn't necessarily a one-to-one to the dong, which is what they use in Vietnam. But I can understand why they're so concerned with keeping the rural community, especially with the sort of Leninist and communistic ideals, even if since the Moi Doi in the last 30 years, they've kind of been reverting, I suppose, to more capitalistic neoliberal policies. I can understand why they want to keep that rural community alive, because there is this sort of idea of self-reliance, but at the same time, when you have your own farm, you can grow enough food for yourself and your family and then also provide for others. It's really not that dissimilar from what the United States tried to do after they bought the Louisiana Purchase and just gave people a bunch of land, because the idea was, oh, we just make everyone farmers, they have their own land, they can grow for themselves, and then everyone's happy. And of course, Mao Zedong famously tried this in China during his quote-unquote communist revolution, and they actually tried it twice in Vietnam, once in 1956 and then again in 1975. The first time they inverted it almost immediately, like they had it for like a year, which is basically they took land from what they called the rich and they gave it to what they considered the poor. Unfortunately, these definitions weren't very well defined and it was very easy to buy your way out of it, ironically enough. So there were plenty of wealthy people who basically paid to be in a lower class. And most of the people whose land was actually taken away were people who had some land enough to feed themselves and their family, but couldn't afford to bribe themselves out of it. So you're basically just moving pieces across the board without actually doing anything. While this is happening, there are, much like Mao Zedong's China, they're creating certain standards by which everyone needs to be producing a certain amount of crop. And of course, those standards every year, they have to keep rising. And once you miss that standard, well, they can't tell the government, right? They can't tell their boss, because it has a certain hierarchy where you don't want to tell the guy above you that you're not making enough. And so that number just gets higher and higher and higher, which luckily in Vietnam, it did not have the same disastrous effects it did in communist China at the time. But in Mao Zedong's China, it created the greatest genocide in human history. In fact, the genocide was so great, they don't even know how many people died. They're like, it could be 20 million, it could be 40 million. And of course, this wasn't purposeful the same way the Holocaust or the destruction of Native Americans in the United States or New Zealand or other parts of the world. But it's the same effect. And in Vietnam, they attempted it twice. The first time, they realized that it wasn't going to work. But the second time, in 1975, when they tried it, they actually did continued the land redistribution for 11 years until Moi Doi came to effect in 1986. But I'm certainly for taking money from the wealthy and giving it to the poor. You know, it's a very good idea. The problem is, how do you do that in a way that's actually fair? And who decides that? Because what always happens, and this is true with most countries that were communists for a time, is it's a great idea and we love it, but then who's making those decisions? And whoever's making those decisions suddenly has a lot, even if they didn't have power before, now they have all this power, and power makes people hungry. And so how do you create a system in which the powerful's power are taken away from them without giving other people that same power?
I see what you mean. And frankly, I'm on the fence as to whether or not land reform actually was a good idea in Vietnam. It's not entirely clear to me whether or not the state owning the farms is any better than private families owning the farms, as they have done. In general, it's a good idea to try to make as much land as possible a part of the commons, in the sense that it's owned not by any person or organization, but by society and whatever the community of people in the area think is the best thing to do with the land, then that's the best thing to do. Where communities, you know, some increasingly large group of people as a country industrializes. Frankly, it's very impressive to me that Vietnam was able to avoid a mass death event that occurred in essentially every other country as it was industrializing. You know, it's easy to point the finger at Russia for its Holodomor of the Ukraine, where they killed millions of people by starving them, Ukrainians, out to produce food for their cities. And it's easy to point the finger at China, who likewise caused a similar genocide by industrializing their farmland. But similar things happened pretty much everywhere on the planet. I mean, we in the United States caused genocides of Native Americans to seize farmlands, or seize land that we then used as farmland. And you could argue even in European countries that we caused a great deal of misery by industrializing farmland, because a lot of these peasants ended up becoming destitute proletarians who were unable to find a job and eventually just died because of it. You know, it might be a low bar, but I find it frankly a little bit surprising that no such event ever transpired in Vietnam, even though industrializing farmland and industrializing the country in general tends to cause a lot of death and suffering. So, I mean, the country still isn't fully industrialized, so, you know, something may yet happen, especially as they become more capitalist and fail to leave behind their authoritarian tendencies that they gained under Ho Chi Minh.
Yeah, I find the history of Vietnam to be one of inspiration in so many ways, just because Vietnam, for most of its history, has just been given a really shitty hand. I mean, basically from the beginning, people are just coming in and taking over their land and taking over their government, and they're saying, you need to learn Chinese, you need to become Confucius, you need to become Buddhist, you need to become Taoist, you need to become Catholic, you need to start speaking French, you need to start speaking Japanese, and so on and so forth. And despite all that, Vietnam has fought back for thousands of years, and despite making very little ground for most of Vietnam's history, the fact that they can unite together and fight against not only China, not only France, but also the United States and Japan, and win, is incredibly impressive. I mean, however you feel about the Vietnam War, however you feel about America's involvement in it, or however you even feel about communism or what have you, or Ho Chi Minh, I think there's something very impressive and a lot to be learned from a country that is willing to strive for independence despite the fact that until very recently they just weren't given that. And I think there's something just very impressive and inspiring about that.
Absolutely. It feels very comforting to know that there's still countries out there made up of people who actually have faith in their government and a sense of strong national identity. Because these days it seems increasingly more difficult to feel like you're a part of any like American project, or that you have some sort of meaningful representation in the government. But in Vietnam, people, despite understanding the great deal of corruption that goes on in the government there, they absolutely seem to feel strongly connected to their government. It seems as though democracy is still a project that the average person feels is worth pursuing, which is more than can be said for many Americans.
Yeah, I find the Vietnamese government to be a seemingly simple yet extremely complex form of government that I'm still, despite many readings and trying to grasp my head around, I'm still sort of struggling with the different positions in the government. I sort of understand the idea that it's a representative democracy in which the people vote for what's called a National Assembly. National Assembly is made up of 500 fellow Vietnamese people. And then this National Assembly votes for a prime minister, a president, and the Supreme Court, and also the leader of the
General Secretariat of the Communist Party.
Yes, the General Secretary of the Communist Party. I understand what the Supreme Court does because it runs very similar to the American Supreme Court system and most Supreme Court systems. That seems to be one of the things that a lot of countries seem to have in common. Whatever part of the world you are, wherever your culture is, Supreme Court seems to be pretty similar around the world. The Prime Minister, I guess I still don't really understand what the Prime Minister does. Do you?
I did a good bit of research into the General Secretariat of the Communist Party. The other parts of the government I'm a little less clear on, but my understanding is that the Prime Minister is essentially the commander-in-chief of the army, and that's kind of their major role, is to regulate military affairs.
Okay. And then the president basically functions as like the Secretary of Foreign Affairs. Like, he's the one who goes out and meets with other countries, at least as far as I understand it. He kind of...
That seems to be the case, yeah. Yes.
And then the General Secretary does...
They organize the Communist Party.
What does that mean?
It means whatever it needs to mean behind closed doors in the National Assembly, essentially. I think part of the idea of the Vietnamese government is that it is deliberately vague and a little bit confusing. I think that this was an intentional choice to try to create a situation where government is essentially capable of anything. Unlike the United States government, which is kind of locked into a path, the heads of state within the Senate, the House, and the President have to play a very specific game to get anything passed. And as a result, that makes it very difficult to cause radical change, like moving the United States towards a more socialist economic and social system is nearly impossible because of it. In Vietnam, it's a lot easier, for example, to completely reform the international system of trade that they use towards a more capitalist one, which is something Ho Chi Minh almost certainly would have vehemently disagreed with, being an old guard communist like he was. But because of the vagaries of the government, because it's not very well defined what anyone's particular role is or what they're expected to carry out and what traditions they're supposed to uphold, because of all that, they were able to neoliberalize the economy and cause radical change in a very short period of time.
In preparation for trying to explain the Vietnamese government, I read the Vietnamese Constitution, which is incredibly short, especially in like comparison to the American Constitution, where there's all these incredibly specific and complicated regulations and rules, which of course most of which are archaic and pointless and useless. If you look at the Vietnamese Constitution, it's only like 6 paragraphs. It's like 2 pages, and it basically just describes what the National Assembly is, what the President is, and the Prime Minister is. What's interesting is the Constitution doesn't explain, they actually don't even mention the General Secretary of the Communist Party within the Constitution, which is one of the reasons why I was struggling to figure out what they actually do, because most of my search was within official Vietnamese government websites that were, I was able to translate into English or were already in English, which, I mean, it's a two-sided coin in so many ways. On the one hand, it can be scary and daunting at times because they can make changes that perhaps the people of Vietnam don't necessarily agree with, and there's not a very easy way to change that. But at the same time, if radical change needs to be made and it's for the better of the Vietnamese people, it can be done and can be done quickly. Where, of course, the U.S. government was entirely built on the idea, the terror of really anything getting done. And so part of the reason the American government is so slow at doing really anything is because it was built that way. It was built to be arbitrarily bureaucratic. It was built to almost be Kafkaesque in so many ways, because the American idea, at least at the time, was the more bureaucratic is, the slower things get done. And the idea was slow is smooth and smooth is fast. Unfortunately, that doesn't really work so well, at least not in the United States. I can't necessarily speak for other countries who have similar types of, I'm putting democracies in air quotes, because the American system isn't technically an official democracy. There's a lot of, it's more of an oligarchy, honestly, than it is a democracy.
It has a democratic aesthetic, but very little control of the people in government, which is not at all similar to the situation in Vietnam, where obviously the federal government of Vietnam is directly elected by the people, which is something Americans dream about, but will probably never happen in this system. Yeah, and I think part of the theory behind the government is that if you have such a small group of people that's directly elected by the people, like the National Assembly is, while it is 500 people, that's bigger than any house in American government, but the whole thing overall is smaller than the entire American government in terms of like elected offices. If you set up a government in that way and you make sure that the elections are not rigged and that they're held fairly, it becomes nearly impossible for a group of people to gain unjust power and become tyrannical because there's just no wiggle room given by the people. There's not enough elected offices to obscure power and cause and carry out tyranny like there are in the United States. And the nature of election cycles is such that no politician can go too far from popular demand, or else they'll risk losing their position of power in the long term.
And the way the Vietnam voting system runs is very similar to New Zealand's voting system, which is, honestly, if the United States actually cared about democracy and wanted people to vote on a regular basis, they would move to a similar system, which is basically everyone in the National Assembly, all 500 people, are up for re-election every 3 years. So that means every 3 years you go in and you vote, which means that not every fucking day do you have to watch the governor, you know, whatever governor of your state, or the senator, or the school board, or this person, that person. Because I think part of the reason that the United States has such a low turnout for so many voting, I mean, you even look at the presidential vote, which people consider to be like the supreme leader of the United States, even though the president doesn't have nearly as much power as people think they do. I mean, look at Donald Trump's stay in office. Even though, obviously, I vehemently disagree with...
That man was exceptionally bad as president, though.
Exceptionally bad, right? I mean, if he was in a different type of government, he could have easily dismantled it. And yet, 4 years in office, and you actually look at what he got done, and while he did commit some things that are atrocious, he really didn't get a whole lot. Like, there really isn't a whole lot change from 4 years ago, especially if you don't account for, right, the coronavirus, which is not really under anyone's control. It was going to happen either way, and so on and so forth. Of course, you know, the CDC could have handled it differently, and a lot of people could have handled it differently. But, you know, even with a presidential election, you're looking at 50, maybe 60% show-up rate for the U.S. But when you have it only every 3 years, when you can only vote every 3 years, it's so much easier. And for the people of Vietnam, they're only voting for one person, right? They're just voting for their person, for their nationals. Of course, they have local officials that they have to vote for also, but those positions are also up every 3 years. So it's basically just one day every 3 years. And you can see very well what they've done the last 3 years. Like, you have to say, well, was this the work of the senator, or was this the work of the governor, or was this the work of this person or that person, or that person? The hierarchy is very clear in that sense, which makes democracy much more efficient. I think it's sort of ironic that in America's attempt to stop quote-unquote tyranny, they ended up creating something much more tyrannical than just having a king. Because, as you were saying, they're able to hide in these bureaucracies, which the National Assembly isn't. I mean, even if you don't like the current president or the current prime minister or whoever, they're going to be up for election in 3 years. And yes, you may not be able to vote for the general secretary directly, but you're voting for the people who vote for the general secretary. I mean, it's a very short chain. I mean, technically, in the U.S., you technically don't vote for the president. That's how Donald Trump won in 2016. You don't vote for the president. You vote for people who vote for the president. So it's still happening in the United States. We've just created this illusion that it's different. But when Vietnam, it's a much more direct trail to the top, and I think it works. So up to recently, a general secretary could only have 2 terms, and then they have to step out of office, similar to president of the United States. But they decided that the general secretary should have his 3rd term because they like the guy that's in office. They're like, that guy, he should have a 3rd term. And they just did it. Like, it wasn't like this huge thing. They just voted and it happened. And, you know, whether you agree with that or not, it's so efficient. And you have to love the efficiency of it. It's just so efficient.
Right. And that's only something that can really occur effectively in a government without, like, total collapse and chaos. If you have a very strong, coherent ideology like Ho Chi Minh's Marxist-Leninism creating the whole thing. I don't think an American-style capitalist Vietnam could function with a National Assembly elected directly by 500 people. I think the only way that you see government like Vietnam's actually being able to get anything done and not collapse into chaos like South Vietnam did, for example, when a coup was made against their president right before the war with North Vietnam, and the country was thrown essentially into complete anarchy. The only way that you avoid that is with an ideology like communism, essentially keeping people in line and keeping people looking towards a similar goal that, while there might be some disagreements in the short term, there's always this idea that the emancipation of the worker and achieving society free of scarcity, that's all present in the minds of everyone in the National Assembly. But that's not really the case in the United States, where there isn't, well, there is ideology in the federal government, but I think it's pretty obvious that pretty much every elected official is deeply cynical of whatever ideology they may hold. And so without that kind of ideology, you sort of need a Byzantine bureaucracy like the United States, because there's no sense among elected officials that there's some goal that we're all working towards. The cynicism that every politician has forces each politician to act as an individual out for their own gain, rather than as a collective under some greater goal, which, you know, might be more abundance, it might be even some policy like universal healthcare. And without that, you can only achieve a situation where a few people are removed from abject poverty. And obviously that causes class divides.
So over the last 30-ish years, Vietnam has moved from a prototypical communist country to more neoliberalistic ideals, much like China has, while still claiming to be communist. Do you think 20 years from now, Vietnam will still be a communist country, at least in name?
In name, yes, absolutely. The same way that the United States was created by its founding fathers, who were like free market liberals. And that's kind of like the ideology of the United States. There will always be like an aesthetic of Karl Marx and Vladimir Lenin in Vietnamese government. I don't think Vietnam is going to be communist. I don't think it is communist anymore. There's a mix of like free market and authoritarian capitalism. And then there's something which is like state-owned economic systems, but it's not really communism because there's a free market that individuals are allowed to participate in. There's definitely a transition there where the people are sort of working in communist systems, but within the next 20, 30 years, I think those systems either get replaced with capitalist ones or they get replaced with some sort of state-controlled system, which is completely different from communism. So yeah, I don't see communism sticking around in practice in Vietnam.
Do you think communism could survive anywhere in the current global economy?
No, probably not. I think once the network of trade between Soviet countries like the USSR and all of its satellite states, and then between China and Vietnam and Cuba and other communist states around the planet, once that all collapsed in the, well, it began to collapse in the 80s, but when it finally collapsed in the early 90s, I think that was it for communism, globally speaking. The only way an ideology can survive at the level of a state government now is if it participates in neoliberal capitalism globally, because that's the only way that you can get resources to build your modern factories. The country that controls all of the rare earth metals that you need to build your computers and stuff, that's a neoliberal capitalist country. So you have to interact with them along those lines to be able to get all those resources.
Well, Brandon, I think I'm out of things to say about Vietnam. Is there anything else before we close out here that you want to touch upon this week?
I think we should talk very briefly about how climate change is going to impact Vietnam, because that's one of the most at-risk countries. I don't have any like prescriptions for what should be done, but I think it is very concerning what sea level rise is going to do to the country, since both of their major cities are in river deltas right next to the ocean, which means they're both at risk of becoming underwater within, you know, the century. So that's not very good. Vietnam is also mostly farmlands, and while it is in the jungle, that kind of insulates it from climate volatility. There's a lot of Vietnam which is like in hills or mountains, and that is, you know, a very high-risk area for drought, which would affect their major export, which is rice, and their food supply, obviously, for the people. So I think Vietnam is probably one of the most interesting countries when it comes to the effects of climate change. It has some of the hardest work to adapt to climate change compared to other countries. I don't know if you have anything to add.
I've read a bit about what's called the climate economy in Vietnam, and they have a very real concern about the current and trajectory of global climate change. They have the ability to be much more aware and act on it for so many reasons than countries like the United States, partly because the United States, you can kind of hide away from it because the United States has such a large just amount of land and places that you can go. You can sort of try to hide from global climate change, with Vietnam being so much a smaller country and being surrounded on many sides by water. It's not great for Vietnam, but I know they're doing everything that they can. But the problem is even if Vietnam was at zero on carbon, they're like, oh shit, we did it. The amount of carbon we're producing is the same that we're, you know, taking out of the atmosphere. Even if they hit zero, 9 million people, I mean, it doesn't matter. Because, you know, if countries like the United States and the UK and China continue to produce at the rate, they're kind of just doomed. It sucks. And there's not really... Vietnam is in a place where they really can't do a lot about it. It's frustrating because, like so many things, the people that are most affected are the people that can do the least about it. And even if Vietnam does everything in their power to go green, you know, the whole country becomes solar power and wind power and hydropower and all that, it doesn't matter. The effect that they're going to have on Earth is so little that they are merely at the whims of the rest of the world. And even if they go to the UN, even though they have the ability to participate in UN, the fact is that even though there's plenty of countries that really haven't done anything for hundreds of years, but because they are, you know, I mean, look at France. Like, what the fuck has France done in the last, you know, 100 or so years? Nothing. They haven't done anything. And yet they have more power at the UN than, you know, so many other countries. And it's incredibly frustrating. And I can only imagine what it's like to... I don't want to in any way appropriate the frustration or the fear of the Vietnamese people or people of anywhere in the world. But it's incredibly frustrating that the people who are affected the most, like, no matter how fucking hard they work, no matter how much they do, I mean, I guess unless they go and fucking take over Japan and China and, you know, other parts of the world, which I don't think they're planning on doing anytime soon. I mean, I won't speak for the Vietnamese government. Maybe they're planning world domination. And, you know, if they do, you know what, all the more to the Vietnamese people and Vietnamese government. I mean, you know, if anyone deserves to take over the world, if anyone deserves to practice a little colonialism, it's them. So, you know.
Hey, you never know. They probably have the most legitimate claim to it, I think, of any country right now. You know, despite all the frustration about it, I think there is a great deal of hope for the current situation, because the severity of climate change and the knowledge that it's going to impact Vietnam in such a drastic way is deeply motivating to the Vietnamese people to create the kind of technologies that are necessary for net zero. So, you know, even though it's going to be a Vietnam that suffers the most from climate change, it will also be countries like Vietnam that create the industries and technologies that will allow the rest of the world to achieve net zero.
So Vietnam, it's up to you. It's not our problem anymore. It's not. You now have to solve climate change.
We Americans, we might be, you know, the leaders of the free world. We might have, you know, literally all of the power, but it's actually not our control. Like, we have no control. So it's all on you. You have no responsibility here. Sorry.
Yeah. All right, y'all. Thank you for listening. You can find everything I do at Austin12.
I have nothing to plug except the Life Through Fiction's YouTube channel and the TikTok and Instagram page.
And you can find the Nom Nom Project here wherever you hear podcasts. You can also find us on TikTok and Instagram at the Nom Nom Project. Thank you all for listening.